Accession number 14974, 4 Armstrong, Reel 5.
Mr. P. Armstrong, Reel 5. Who was in charge of the mess, Mr. Armstrong?
The president of the messing committee, which could actually be any officer appointed by vote from the other officers of the battalion. Generally speaking, in a battalion mess, it's normally a company commander. In a mess, everyone is supposed to be equal, but in fact the only person who is entitled to be called sir is the colonel. Otherwise one is supposed to be equal, but in those early days there was a tendency for senior officers to forget that they were in the mess and forget things like equality. This changed naturally. The president of the messing committee was responsible for seeing that the day-by-day function of the mess was carried out, having under him a mess sergeant, several stewards, orderlies, one cook with a deputy cook and a handyman, and that pretty well was it. The officer, the PMC who was running the mess, generally had a driver to run him about on mess business, for instance the purchase of extra foods, and also very essentially the purchase of drink. One got the ordinary rations delivered to the officer's mess as the war of his entitlement. But of course, the charge that I mentioned earlier was to supplement this mess, this army issue. And of course, it could be anything in reason when you think of a basic pay of the subaltern was 11 shillings a day then. A full lieutenant got 13 shillings a day, and I've forgotten what happened after that. But you can see that one couldn't be expected to pay very much. Of course, accommodation was free, with
did you have to, obviously you would have to pay for your own drink?
Yes. Drink was one thing that was paid for by signing a chit for everything that you did and then that you took. And at the end of the month, the chits were added up and you were given a note of how much you owed and were expected to pay it forthwith. This actually made you a teeny little bit cautious as to what you drank in the mess.
Was it useful to have a private allowance to assist you? In
oh, yes, indeed. Of course it was, because you think it's hard now when money's so ridiculously valued. It's hard now to be able to say so, but out of 11 shillings a day, that's not a lot of money. And if you take a normal mess would charge something like about two and sixpence a day out of the 11 shillings. So it left you with about £2, as we would know it nowadays, £2.50 to live on. That was to discharge things like you paid your servant who laid out your kit and looked after you, everything, your basic needs, cleaned your equipment, cleaned your boots, and this sort of thing. In return for that, your batman was allowed to be excused certain duties. Depending on how harsh you were, and how efficient he was showed how many duties he was excused.
What kind of payment would you give your servant?
Very hard to remember now, but initially I think he got half a crown a week. His pay wasn't very magnanimous by any means, but he got all sorts of extra privileges, as you can quite imagine. And he also, how shall I put it, if he was good, it made your life absolutely marvellous. You hadn't the worry of thinking of where, for instance, in the field you were going to sleep, or where, I'm talking now about outside the mess, where you were going to even find where your ground sheet and bivouac was going to be when you were out on manoeuvres. If a good batman did this automatically, if you had a poor batman, you must get rid of him.
Did you have some choice in batman? Did someone say, "Yo, this will be a good chap for you," or was that
no? You were you generally knew the men of your platoon and discreetly sounded out through the sergeant, because obviously in a platoon you rely very, very much on your sergeant to carry out orders and to sound as to what the men are feeling in case there are things that you don't know that you should know. And this is how I got my first batman. My sergeant said, "Well, he's a scamp, he's idle, he's been ruined by his mother, he gets a bigger allowance from home than you do, but I think at heart, basically, he'll be all right." So I took him, George Butler. And I must be honest with you when I say that George was everything a batman could be. He had some rather unorthodox methods. For instance, I found one day as an old soldier cleaning my brasses and blancoing my equipment. And when I asked him why, he was a little bit upset, a little bit worried. And then I found that my batman was paying him to clean my brasses and buttons. This is the sort of thing that happens. He didn't want responsibility. He was happy to be my batman. But once we were in the field, he was rather marvellous. And many times when I thought there'd be nothing to eat, it appeared. And when there was nowhere to sleep, he found somewhere. So in the end, I was hospitalised. And when you were hospitalised, after 3 weeks, you're what they call whitelisted, and you leave the battalion. And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, Butler, but I'm going to hospital. I'm afraid I won't be coming back here. I shall miss you." "Oh," he said, "that's all right, sir. I'll go into hospital as well." Interestingly enough, when I was talking to one of the nurses afterwards, she said, "Oh, there's a soldier asking after you, sir." And I said, "A soldier?" She said, "A private butler." I said, "And what is wrong with private butler?" She said, "Oh, very, very serious. Back and stomach troubles." The next time I saw private butler was on leave. I was taking my wife out to dinner in the hotel in Durham, and this gentleman, well-dressed gentleman, came across and said, "What, sir, you're still in the army?" How foolish. He was then in munitions.
So it was a good thing to have a batman who had certain abilities to scrounge.
Yes, that is it. Absolutely, that is the thing that he required. And he also was helpful in giving you ideas of when, for instance, the battalion was going to move, because the last person to be told was normally a subaltern. But the network through the other ranks meant that my batman normally had packed before I heard where that we were moving, and he knew where we were going before I had even been informed this. So a good batman, yes, was very, very useful. The officer's mess, to come back to it, it could be quite an onerous job, because food was rationed, and it wasn't the thing to be getting food that other people couldn't get, the civilian population. And also drink became in short supply, so one had to exercise great ability in finding the things that went towards making life in the mess a happy life. And I became president of the messing committee after the deputation had been to see about the problem of the civilian chef. And I became acquainted, for instance, with a very helpful pheasant farmer, a man who'd come from Bishop Auckland, where he had an hotel. And so I was able to get extra meat for the mess without robbing the population of food. Then there was a store where we were billeted, where we were able to get spirits, which were always popular. And we bought our other extra supplies from this store in return for the issue of the spirits, the purchase of the spirits, I should say. In wartime, of course, once the battalion moved from this place, it was spread out into companies, and a company mess then normally is the PMC, normally would be the second in command, a captain, and he would have a cook, sometimes good, sometimes bad, and in a smaller scale it would be run just the same way, but very few amenities.
Was there a close check kept on officers who were getting into debt through overpaying on, ordering too much drink or whatever it was?
If they couldn't pay the bills, you can quite imagine that there'd be no supply. It was quite simple. You could speak to a man, but the simplest way to do is to tell the mess orderlies that Mr. X or Captain Y isn't to be supplied. And in that way, it was made sure that, at least in the mess, he didn't overspend.
And was that the mess president's job to give out that information, or to bring that about?
Discreetly, yes. It was never mentioned to anyone else besides the mess president mentioned it to the officer concerned. And if the officer concerned persevered in overspending, he was literally cut out.
In a battalion mess, was there a traditional ritual to the way that the day went?
Well, it was now wartime. In peacetime, it's rather different altogether, as you can imagine, because there's no... I'm not being rude when I say this. There's no urgency about anything. Life can drift happily along. Against that is the fact in peacetime most of the officers live out with the wives and families, and so the mess is merely the home of the odd subalterns and possibly a bachelor major. And interestingly enough, this I went out when there was an inquiry into the treatment of national servicemen in the 50s. I went out on a course of inquiry. There were senior officers from the Territorial Army were sent to all the regiments in Germany, and I was sent to an engineer regiment stationed at Hamelin. And when I arrived there, there were no officers above the rank of lieutenant in the mess. The colonel had gone off to Hamburg, the second in command had gone boating somewhere, and the rest of the officers just departed. By the Monday, several came back, but not many. And the battalion was being, the regiment, I beg your pardon, was being run by the warrant officers and the orderly officer of the day, which rather surprised me. And another peculiar thing happened to me. I was sitting having a drink in this mess, and an officer came up to me and talked for a little while. And then he said, of course, sir, I'm a regular. And I said, are you indeed?
Did you find any evidence that national servicemen were being misused?
Oh, yes. It was really appalling. I used to get up each morning at 6:30, and the troops were building pontoon bridges across the Weser, so I went down to watch them arriving at the bridging site possibly about 7:30 to 8 in the morning when they just started, and I observed to my astonishment that there were two parties. One party, I understood from questioning the warrant officer in charge, were national servicemen, and the other party were regulars. And when I asked why, he said, well, these people will be gone soon, and we have to rely on the regulars to make sure that the bridges are built properly. But I said, they are to be taught, surely. He was a little nonplussed, but a thing I observed, as he walked up and down, he had in his hand a stick about 2 foot long. And whilst I didn't see anything improper, when I asked him what this stick was for, he looked at it as though he was looking at a serpent and said, oh, it was just to point out what these chaps had to do. And I said, if I were indisposed towards you, I would think that it could be used as a threat. No, sir. No, indeed. This was the trouble.
To come back to the mess, after the civilian chef left, who took over the cooking and food preparation?
An army cook. There was... the army had, as you know, the various services, service corps, pay corps, the rest of it, and there were army cooks. And I suppose we got the worst of the cooks because the men were naturally in greater numbers. But the cook we got was a good man. He tried his best. I felt that we lived quite comfortably. And so things went on perfectly reasonably after that.
How many people then were working for the officers in the mess? And what tasks had they? You mentioned the cook.
Well, you see, each officer had a batman who was responsible for looking after his officer, making of his bed and setting out his equipment and the rest of it. And he could be drafted in to help out. For instance, he brought you a cup of tea in the morning. Before you got up, everyone had in the army had the mug of tea, and he did that, and then he could be expected to help. For instance, there would be a little bit of clearing up possibly, but generally speaking, the mess was run by the mess. There was a mess sergeant, a corporal, and I think, from memory, four orderlies. There was a cook and an assistant cook, and then all the men that were, not all the men, but such men as were on a charge on Jankas would be brought in, for instance, to peel potatoes and fetch and carry. So it wasn't run on a, there weren't a large number of people employed. And in the same sort of way, they doubled up. They had other jobs to do, just as the bandsmen became RMC equivalent workers. So the mess cooks and so on became orderlies at headquarters.
Did you have special mess nights whilst you were down in Oxfordshire?
Yes, in that we used to invite officers from our sister battalions, which were the 8th and the 9th, comprising with the 6th, the 151 Brigade, and this was part of 50th Division.
There was no special dress for this occasion?
Well, in those days, we were still wearing... It's hard to tell you. We hadn't got battle dress then. It hadn't arrived. And so we were still wearing our dress. But we weren't in our greens. They were put away. And memories play a false, I know. But I can't remember an occasion when we did wear them during that period. So I'm sure that they must have been kept. We had our swords, naturally, but they fitted with your Sam Brown and the rest of it. So, no, I don't remember wearing a mess kit during that time.
Was there a tradition to the Durham Light Infantry mess night that was different from other regiments?
Oh, yes. We had this very interesting tradition of sitting for the loyal toast, which of course the Navy have and other people, but we were very proud of this.
Was this part of the regimental history?
It's part. This is part of the regimental history, and
goes back a long time, doesn't
it? Yes, a long time, and unfortunately, I had a note of it.
What was the purpose of being in Chipping Norton?
It was for the division to learn to act as a division. Starting with battalion exercises and eventually working up to brigade exercises. But as we were so, shall we say, untrained at that time, it had to be absolutely basic in that the platoon had to be taught to work as a unit itself. That is, the subaltern, the captain, the sergeant, lance sergeant, lance corporals, and the rest of the platoon, amounting in total to 35 men. It was generally, at that time, training meant that you had three sections, and one learnt the use of three sections, either arrowhead, or three sections up, or two up and one back, all these variations which we used to try and push into our men.
Could I ask you, arrowhead, how did that function?
One section forward, and two sections, one to the right, one to the left, slightly in rear. They needn't necessarily be absolutely level with one another, but generally speaking, you can think of it as an arrowhead. The other method, of course, is to have two up and one at the back. And actually, I think that is the harder of the two methods. Or even the three sections advancing at one, which is very rare.
This is in some kind of...
open line. Order. Sorry. The troops are working in open order. That is to say, they about, how shall I put it, a minimum of 6 foot apart, but running up to 10-15 feet as long as you can see the person on each side of you, so that the corporal in charge of that section can control it, and the sergeant, who generally speaking is well up, is to the rear, he can watch over all. The officer commanding, strictly speaking, if doing a job that he's been given to do, would be up with the leading section.
And is this a steady advance?
This is when you're advancing.
Did you bring into that fire and movement or anything?
Yes. This, once you've taught them the art of moving as a unit, then you've got to teach them how to move by covering each section, covering one another, and leapfrogging so that the advance is held up as little as possible. One has to take cover, which often meant that you went off your axis, but you had to bear in mind the way where you were moving and to keep, generally speaking, that direction. Don't forget, you're not working as an isolated body. On either side, hopefully, you have another platoon, and beyond them, further platoons, and eventually another company. So you can see how the line can be moving quietly and steadily forward. But in wartime, this is what one hopes for, but rarely gets.
How do you bring into that a change of direction in your advance, a marked change?
In the infantry, strictly speaking, the orders should be by whistle. One wore a lanyard and a whistle in the top pocket, and that should indicate it. But generally speaking, one used hand signals. They often were the best, because often you wanted to change the direction without anyone else knowing you were changing direction, and a whistle, of course, is impossible. So it becomes a question of you all depend on each other, and all I can say is the harder you train, the better your men become.
Would you pivot or change direction on one person?
No.
As a
if there's any change in direction, it's the platoon changes direction by watching the front section move, and they are given corresponding signals. You can actually bring them by hand signals, double up, and this business of move, it's quite simple.
Extended arm.
They're very, very quickly. It's an interesting thing about the British soldier that he finds it difficult to take anything seriously until in a life-threatening situation. It was very exasperating. But we persevered, and in our battalion, we were very, very well blessed with our NCOs. In our army, as I noticed in the German army, the NCOs, who are generally long-serving people, made an enormous difference to the performance of the troops.
So we dealt with platoon training at that level. All the training in effect as a territorial before the war, then
very small.
Must have been very small.
Very, very limited indeed, because we only met the full battalion only met at camp for 2 weeks in the year, and in that time you had to get to know who you were with and who you were meeting. You possibly saw your men for the first time. when the Territorial Army was doubled up in 38, it was the first camp that a lot of the people had seen. 50% had never ever seen anyone else before.